some music to get you in the mood for today's show. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're talking insects today, bees, hornets, and, all kinds of things that might be getting into your house, including the brown marmorated stink bug, which is apparently finding its way into a lot of homes right here in Wisconsin. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he stops by to talk about insects every few months. So it's always great to have him come by. And hey, for you, are there some bugs that are bugging you right now? We can talk about Asian lady beetles too, as well as the stink bugs and a whole lot more. Maybe you have a photo of an insect that's kind of a cool photo, or maybe you just wonder what the insect is. You can email that to us at ideas@wpr.org or phone in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. And Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Well, I've got limey. My lime tree is still sitting out on the second story deck, and probably be bringing limey in a couple of weeks or a week or two. It's starting to get to the point where a lime tree ought to be coming inside. But, you know, you always worry a little bit about what might come in with limey.
Sure. So it was quite common for me to get calls in the lab in November and December of plants that were placed outside for the summer, brought in, and all of a sudden we get an explosion of spider mites. And to be honest, those spider mites were on the plants when they're outdoors, but the environmental conditions are such that they don't thrive. They do well in hot, dry conditions. So you bring them into a heated home and they explode. Now, the problem is when you got something big like that to treat indoors. So it's probably a good practice to treat your plants before you bring in, and you can use the insecticidal soap products. Oh. Pretty widespread, you know. The only problem is that usually it takes two applications because they don't kill the eggs very well. So usually you treat, then treat again in a couple weeks, you're fine. The other headaches that we get are various critters in the soil, things like fungus, gnats, and even once in a while I find ants move in, millipedes. They don't pose the plant any problem. It's just the nuisance of bringing things in. And so in particular, if you're adding organic matter to the soil, some of the non-organic potting mixes won't support those kind of critters. But as I said, if you've got some organic matter, fungus gnats are more than happy to take advantage of that.
So I should probably be treating limey right away. And then
I think just as a precaution. Yeah, because again, the difficulty of spraying indoors, it would be the same suggestions, but you know, then you usually got to get tarps and things, and so that you don't get the soapy water on the floor and the like. And so like I said, I just get nervous. Now, it's been raining enough and whatnot. It's not been the kind of conditions that spider mites would should be very happy outdoors, but all it takes is a couple. So
yeah, it only takes a couple. So, and are they going to do a lot of damage if they do get in on your flowers and so forth?
Well, spider mites, it's kind of like taking a piece of sandpaper to the plant, and you get this kind of stippled effect, and it desiccates it dry. So it can kill it. It definitely can in the right circumstances.
Well, lots of callers online. Karen has a question. It's not about an insect, but maybe you've got some answers for her. Karen in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, yeah, I want to go underground for just a minute. I've got those horrible, icky jumping worms in my yard. I live on the near west side in the Hill Farms neighborhood, and I've done a little bit of research, and I've heard that there is a fertilizer called Early Bird.
Mm-hmm.
300, it's nitrogen, I guess, basically, that is being used as a vermicide or something against the jumping worms. And I'm freaked because my whole yard, there's no lawn. It's all perennials, and my backyard is all raspberries, and I have jumping worms everywhere. I mean, they are just disgusting. So
sure.
I need to do as much as I can before I see. I mean, I don't even know what to expect as far as the, you know, the landscape change over the next several years. But is there, do you have any advice about applying this stuff, if it's a good idea? You know, I was a little concerned, well, if I'm introducing nitrogen, will that be a problem for the lakes,
sure.
The water table, that kind of thing? So any advice you've got, I'd be happy to hear.
Well, I feel your pain because we went from a couple jumping worms, which I really was reluctant to tell my wife about last year because she's an avid gardener. to them exploding this year in our own flower beds and the like. And the first thing, from what I have looked at, and, you know, you might find it interesting, but technically worms don't fall in an entomologist's package of expertise. But when you hear, you know, some people report that, you know, aside from being very aggressive on organic matter in breaking that down, that probably is the biggest impact. But as far as affecting plants, I think the verdict is still out. And, you know, some people, their plants aren't doing well. They blame it on jumping worms. Other people have had jumping worms for a while. And they just can't, if you do the research, find declines associated with it, the jumping worms. And so it's not the end of the world, I guess, is the first part. Now, the caution about the fertilizer product, and Larry and I were talking about this before the show started, is this product is sold as an organic fertilizer, but it has basically a seed extract that is toxic to worms. But it's in such a dilute form, and it is so expensive that it really is questionable if you're going to get a positive effect out of it. You know, it will be somewhat minor. The problem is there is no product registered for controlling worms. You know, because normally, you know, back in the day, we all were taught that worms were beneficial, even though it turns out that they're not native to the Wisconsin landscape since the Ice Age. So they are introduced. In the problem with the jumping worm is it's we know in a forested ecosystem they will cause major problems because of the change in the soil structure and the like. But in gardens and the like, where we can supplement mulch and other things, it kind of looks that like it's going to have less impact than people think. So I think it's going to be kind of a stay tuned. The only thing I can see what might happen is you might have to reapply your mulch a little bit more often because they're going to degrade that quicker for you. But other than that, as I said, at least my hope in our yard that that's what we're going to experience is, as I said, my bark mulch is going to decay quicker. But, you know, I'm not seeing any lawn effects. There's no plant effects that I can see yet. But boy, after we had those heavy rains, I was blown away by the number of jumping worms that were in the backyard.
Yeah. So there is, well, that's what we got for you, Karen. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill in Rice Lake has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
The pest I have the most problem with are box elder bugs. outside of the house, because they try to find their way inside.
Sure.
I can go outside with a fly swatter and kill everyone that I can see. That could amount to hundreds. I can go back in the house and come back outside a half hour later, and they're back.
Okay, so the question, this year in particular, are you seeing them as bad this year as we have in past years?
Yes.
Wow. I'm somewhat amazed at that is, you know, box elder bugs go through two generations a year. They do most of their breeding on box elder, but they also will use silver maple. And this is their trick. As adults, they come into sheltered sites. They have very few natural enemies, but the one thing that usually does them in is a fungus disease that's associated with high moisture levels. So dry late summers and falls, we got lots of them, and usually in wet years. And so I have seen very few in a lot of the areas. So as I said, I'm...
Rice Lake was drier probably than southern Wisconsin for sure. So okay. Maybe that's part of it.
So now the problem is when you get these nice, you know, sunny, above 55, 60 degree days, that kind of gets them moving and active. They will accumulate on the sunny side of the house just looking for shelter. And as you mentioned, whether you physically kill them, you can spray them with soapy water sprays. That kills them quite well, but they just keep coming. And this will continue until it finally gets cold enough for them to stop. And then the problem is the ones that snuck into the siding and in the attic. When you get a warm day, you'll see them in January crawling around the house. And those are the ones that came in this past fall. So it's one of two options. You either try to get things sealed tight enough, all the little nooks and crannies that they can squeeze into so that they stay outside and don't cause that nuisance side. Again, you can use a soapy water as a contact spray, but the warning with that is there's no residual. So 2 hours later, it doesn't matter. There are other sprays that are used outdoors. These are very similar to the barn sprays that we use in farm situations that have enough residual that they'll kill these invading insects for 2 to 3 weeks. coming in. And again, you'd spray it on the sunny side of the house. And for box elder bugs, more up than down. I mean, I don't worry so much right at ground level because most of the time you watch them crawling upwards and they'll get up in the soffits and around the window frames and the like. But, you know, the warning there is that no matter what you do next year, it's like a new game. The other thing to look at, and this usually doesn't work, but sometimes if there's only one box elder tree close to the house and that tree is removed, you've basically removed the breeding site. If you have a whole woodlot full of box elder trees, then it doesn't work. Or I'd run in this case a lot where the neighbor had the tree and the neighbor was not interested in removing the tree, and that caused some neighbor disputes at times. So as I said, you basically gear up, and we're almost getting the time of the year, you're towards the end of it. I usually pick about the 10th, 15th of September that I would like to start my strategy to start stop them coming in. Because as I said, that's
kind of too late now.
Yeah, it may just be, even if you did everything perfect right now, enough have snuck in that you're still going to have the nuisance for the rest of the winter.
There you go, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. Phil, do you want to take a look at the email that we got from Shelby? She found this spider. It's kind of a, looks like a fairly large.
Okay, I've got a different critter here, but I'd seen the spider before. I don't see enough of the spider to be 100% sure, but my gut feeling, it's a wolf spider. You got a better picture than I do, Larry. That's not fair.
So Phil's taking a look. You think it's a wolf spider,
right?
Well,
I don't think I've ever seen that marking on a wolf spider. But the thing about wolf spiders, they're a wandering spider. They're big and ugly looking. Typically, they've got more banding legs and not quite as pronounced the markings on the abdomen as this particular one. But there's a number of species. And so they wander around looking for food, so they don't really have a nest per se. And, you know, they look scary, but nothing to worry about. And because the habitat in the house is not really good for them, it's not like they're going to set up housekeeping and live in your house and have babies. They're out in the woods and gardens type of spider. So
there you go. Well, we have Martin in Madison with a question for you. So let's go there. Hi, Martin.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Hey, so yeah, I'm just a university student. I live on campus at UW-Madison, and I was just wondering about stink bugs and I think they're ladybugs or Asian flying ladies. I was wondering about where they came from, and it's just that, like, I don't know, I have so many stink bugs.
Sure.
probably 15 of them, just like dead, near my window. So I was wondering, what can we do to prevent them from coming in? Like, are they coming in through the air conditioning or like under screens?
Yeah, probably under screens, window frames. You know, so the Asian lady beetle problem started in Wisconsin in 1992. The first intercepts of that insect were just a few years before that down in New Orleans. And that appears to be a accidental introduction, although USDA used to release these things for other purposes, but they were never quite successful. The Asian stink bug, the marmorated stink bug, problem started to rumble in the early 2000s in the Pennsylvania area, and then have migrated from there. And our first records, if I remember right, were about 2010. But the problem with both those critters is that, just like the box elder bug, they overwinter as adults, they seek shelter. And being non-natives, kind of typical of invasive insects, their populations are kind of out of whack. They're really much higher than what our native, more balanced species would have. And so the more seams and cracks that are in a building, the more places they can get into. But I've seen them on a 13th floor of a building, so it's, you can't get too high to get away from them. And their activity will come and go depending on the outside air temperature. But again, from this September, October period of time, every time you get a sunny day, it's kind of like you get everybody charged up and they keep coming. And the question is, you know, in a perfect world, you could find out where the places are and seal them up.
And here's, you know, Martin in an apartment where you've got all kinds of places.
You know, and especially if you get an older building, it's just so many seams and cracks, you know, that it may be very difficult. Now, again, you can go to the hardware store and buy sprays to put around the outside of the window frame. And I would really argue spraying outside is far more effective than spraying inside. The problem inside is they already got there and die, and you still got to clean them up. And the sprays have some repellency. I'll also tell you that you'll generally find the Asian lady beetles are easier to kill than the stink bugs. The products that we're using for stink bugs are only marginally effective, and that's what's been frustrating. And it's been, in all the places in the state where it's been a problem, the west side of Madison for the last couple, 3 years have definitely been the hot spot. And it's been interesting because I knew this problem was coming even before I retired. It has been slow to develop as severely as I suspected, but we haven't seen anything yet. If you look at what happened in Maryland and New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and I hope we don't get there, but instead of a dozen, people start talking about hundreds coming in. And even though they're harmless, that's not a good feeling for having stink bugs crawling around in your house and when you're sleeping and the whole thing. So he said, for now, if you can see any kind of, you know, holes in the screen, those kind of things that are obvious, sometimes caulking around window frames or other devices. For most structures, you got to be sure that the vents up in the roof are screened properly with small enough mesh screen that the insects can't get in, because that's often an access point. And once they get in the attic, they can come down through light fixtures and other things.
There you go, Martin. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Dave Potratz, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW entomologist. Great to have him back, and certainly thank you for listening in today. If you have a photo, you can always email it to our ideas@wpr.org address. Phone us at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Lots of callers online, so let's go to Louisa in Menominee next. Louisa, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hello. I discovered jumping worms in one of the gardens I work in last year, and I have had positive results in getting rid of them. Last fall, when I had them positively identified by UW Extension, and last year when I took a sampling of a square foot in the garden, there were 28 in a square foot.
Wow.
And they were making the garden suffer. They turned the soil into something like coffee grounds. It was very dry. Things like marigolds were not thriving. So, and that, you know, usually they thrive anywhere.
Yeah.
And it, because they were depleting the soil, because there were so many of them.
So what did you do?
What did I do? Okay, I did two things. And I talked to Bernadette Williams at the DNR.
Yeah.
And the things that she recommended were biochar and the early bird product, which you mentioned before but said that it was expensive. I don't feel that way after seeing the results I got, because I bought a 50-pound bag. It cost me $60. I did two treatments to get rid of them, and the important thing to remember is the adults die during the winter, but the eggs don't. So they hatch out in the spring, and you have to wait until they've hatched out to apply the product. Otherwise, you won't kill them, because it doesn't kill the eggs. But if you get that first crop that hatches out, then it inhibits their ability to lay more eggs. What I did was I did two treatments. I did it early in the spring, as soon as I determined they were hatching out, and they won't be big at that point. They'll be little tiny things, so you gotta, You don't look for a big worm. You look for a little worm. And then I did it again in the beginning of July, because I figured any of them I hadn't gotten would have laid eggs and they would be hatching again. Mm-hmm. And while I did I also put the biochar in, because I was told by Bernadette that, and I did 20 pounds for 1,500 square foot garden at each application. And then Bernadette said that the biochar would help because it has sharp little edges that don't decompose. They won't round out through time. It's like you put it in the soil, it's always going to be a detriment to these worms because they get punctured. And the regular worms have a mucus layer that doesn't affect them as much as these dumping worms do with the biochar. Anyway, I put that into, and that's supposed to be have permanent long-term effects. Anyway, I feel like I've gotten results, and I would recommend people doing this because they were so insidious, they were harming the garden.
Well, thanks a lot, Louisa, for calling. Appreciate it. So the early bird, if it applied at the proper time, perhaps, and maybe a couple of applications.
You know, where my comments come from is I'm aware of research that has been done with the product that's in the early bird material itself that is toxic to the worms, but used as a concentrate. And so then you'd spray it like anything else. And the problem is that product has not been developed or registered for that use. And so that the only way the early bird people got this product through is to make a very dilute form and call it a fertilizer. And, you know, again, if you've got to get rid of them and your garden's going, I understand it. But, you know, $60 investment is, as I said, it's significant. I don't think you walk into this lightly seeing what the battle is. It will be interesting if this persists. Now, as far as the abrasive product, you know, we have used similar types of strategies sometimes for ant control in golf courses of using products. Or same thing, they have used against night crawlers are a problem on golf courses. They have used some of these abrasive products to some positive effect. And so I can see that too. I mean, I'm curious if that had to be rototilled in or how you work that into the soil to get the distribution to be effective. But that's encouraging. You know, if this ever, what I find curious about jumping worms is this has been something that's been established for quite a longer period of time down south, and you don't hear them complaining about the plant problems. I know what you mean about the coffee grounds. I experienced the same type of thing, and as I said, we'll see in the next couple of years how the Pelletieri garden holds up to this. I'm hoping it doesn't go downhill, but I've seen other cases. And then where things really get crazy is when you start talking about lawns, because I don't know how it'd be more difficult to work this stuff in that situation.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see, Pat in Brookfield, it's your turn. Hi, Pat.
Good morning. I have a question regarding, I think they're flying ants. Every autumn, at about dusk, these ants come flying out of the lawn, and they just come for, I'm saying, maybe 5 minutes if that, and then they're gone. And then a couple of weeks, I thought we were done with them, and a couple of weeks later, I looked out in my garden, and just in a little patch in the garden, there were trillions of flying ants coming out of that garden.
Sure.
So I wanted to know what I can do, or is it hazardous, or what?
Yeah, no, nothing to worry about. It's common. There's two groups of ants that go through this, what we would call a swarming phase in the fall. The big mound-building field ants do that, but the ones in your yard where the mounds are much smaller and maybe not very obvious, we call cornfield ants, and there's about three or four species. And so what's happening is these colonies live for a number of years. The winged forms are the reproductives, the kings and queens. And they have this kind of synchronized emergence where all the adults come out and fly away. It's typically a nice, sunny, late afternoon. And sometimes what you will find is those weather conditions are not met every day. So you'll see them one day, and then it gets cloudy and rainy for 3 or 4 days. You think they're gone, and then you get another nice day, and you see the swarm again. Sometimes you can even tell what's going on because you see little flocks of birds flying as they're catching the ants as they fly up into the wind, because these things are just packed with protein. They're really a very good diet for the birds. But it's just a natural phenomena. And the only time I would get concerned is if I saw a swarm in the house. And even then, it's more of a nuisance. And usually the ants that swarm inside are different species than this cornfield and field ant we see outside. Carpenter ants, they swarm in the spring. So when you see this group of winged forms, it sometimes suggests to us what the critter could be.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. And Tom in Stoddard, thank you for calling.
Hi, Bill and Larry.
Hi.
I have a question. I was sitting here at my desk with a plant that has not been outside ever, but it might have picked up something from a previous plant that was the previous year. But now, here's this little dot on the underside of a leaf. This is a silver vase epiphyte tropical plant that's related to the pineapple, which is the only species, the pineapple is the only species that lives on the ground. These guys are like orchids in the trees. And so this little dot, anyway, I got it pulled off of there and onto a piece of white paper, and I took my hand lens, which is used for coin collecting and looking at jewelry and so on, and right down in high magnification, it's this little black, two little black beetles marching along. So is that thrips? I had been seeing these little brown spots on the leaves, and I was wondering what it was, and even took it into a garden center, and they had no idea what it was.
Okay. Your description at first suggests a scale insect to me more than anything else. Thrips are small little things. They don't make this shell, although when you opened it up, I'm a little perplexed. So there's a number of scales that you get on tropical plants, and they're typically not found in our climate outdoors, and so our plants can't really become contaminated that way. Usually they're contaminated by access to another plant that's infested. And that's why when you bring new tropical plants in, it's good to isolate them for a couple, 3 months just to make sure you don't bring any unpleasant critters. Now, much like we talked about for the spider mites, this product that's sold as insecticidal soap is really effective against almost everything. Aphids, it's not the best, but adequate. For thrips, I would probably use something different. But for these kind of plants, and again, because of the life cycles, but if it was scale, I would think that you'd see more of these structures on other leaves. It bothers me that you only saw one. And so then, you know, I start getting into odd cases of, you know, is it an egg mass of something that just happened to place it there and you opened it up and the like, and it's not really a plant problem at all. And so I'm a little hesitant to kind of go overboard because even though insecticidal soap is pretty mild on plants, certain plants don't get along with it. And so I'd hate to injure the plant by a treatment that isn't necessary. Now, some people for scales have had luck literally just pulling them off by hand. Some people tell me they use isopropyl alcohol, which is a moderate contact kill. It's not the best, but it's not bad. Or again, you could maybe rather than spray the whole plant, just buy some insecticidal soap and just wipe a couple of those leaves that appear to be affected and see if it makes a difference, rather than treating the whole plant. So let's do a, you know, kind of a wait and see, but definitely keep observing and see if it goes in a direction that says, yeah, we got to take care of it or not. So
there we go. Good luck, Tom. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org with your photo or question. And now on to Jill in Waukesha. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
We went away over Labor Day, and we came back, and I was noticing all these little tiny flies in my house. I did overwater a plant. I got a hold of PJ in Madison, and I sent him a picture, and he identified these little flies as forage flies. So I was catching and killing about 10 a day, and I was finding them in every room. Now I haven't found one for about a week and a half. I put these glue papers up on my windows, and that's where I would catch them. Now I caught two like a week and a half ago, but now I'm finding these little teeny tiny little specks. And I don't know if those are baby forage flies. And what can I do to make sure I'm getting rid of them, and how did I get them?
Sure.
So forward flies, a baby forward fly would technically be a maggot. So they're definitely not, the black specks are not the critters. Now, forward flies, in the scheme of things, tend to breed on organic matter sources that are pretty rich and somewhat damp. And honestly, so you find them in dead animals. You sometimes find them in animal waste. We sometimes see them coming out of sewers, but in particular, if it's a sewer that has more organic matter than the norm. And so the first thing normally in an indoor situation is we try to find the food source and get rid of them. I will tell you, we had an outbreak back when I was a graduate student. They were rearing cockroaches, and they were feeding them basically a dog food-like product and adding water. And as all this stuff was rotting in the base of the cockroach cage, it bred incredible numbers of forward flies, much to the disappointment of most of the people in the building. But so as I said, it's encouraging that they went away, which suggests the food source is gone. I'm a little perplexed what the little black spots are. Conceivably, could it be the waste from the flies? You know, some flies.
That's what I was thinking.
That could be, but I don't normally associate forward flies with lots of fly specks, is what we call them. So I'm not totally sure there, but I can assure you it's not baby forward flies. And as I said, it may just be whatever the food source is, either dried up or they ate it all and you had this hatch. Normally, houseplant soil is not rich enough. Unless you're putting, again, some kind of animal waste or something with it. And the other place we find it, believe it or not, is in cemeteries. And I won't go any farther than that.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thanks for that call, Jill. Marjorie emailed a photo, a bug she found on a daylily leaf a couple of weeks ago. All sorts of other little bugs, sort of aphid-looking, crawling all over it, and tiny spiders, too. It's about 3/4 of an inch long. Got a nice photo of it here, black. With some tannish yellow.
Yeah, it's a neat critter, you know, with that banding and stuff. Yeah. So it's a carrion beetle. Oh. And as the name implies, you normally expect carrion beetles to be associated with dead animals. Now, if you ever look at a carrion beetle under a microscope, it's quite common to see little mites and other creatures hitchhiking on it. That's how these mites go from one dead animal to the next. They use this is their airplane, basically. So that's kind of an interesting place to see them. It's not typical to see them on fresh, nice-smelling stuff. Although I will tell you also, they are attracted to nightlight. So sometimes people would see one, you know, sitting outside the door of the house wondering how that got there. But definitely nothing to worry about, and said more of a curiosity.
And Mark in Milwaukee, or I'm sorry, Steve emailed to ask if there are any new insecticides for bed bugs. He has heard about a possible new biological product that causes the bed bugs to lose reproductive capacity.
The thing about bed bugs, you know, people have looked for a lot of novel ways to control them, including insect hormones, which it sounds like this is one of those products. People have been looking at pheromones and the like, and you know, there is some encouraging, but the bottom line is I have not seen the magic bullet other than heat. I mean, heat is the one product that they are not going to develop a resistance to. It's always going to have efficacy and the like. And so, you know, I'm aware of it. Although I remember one of the original experiments with one of these insect hormones, it killed some of the bed bugs. But if you looked at it over time, the ones it didn't kill, it caused them to have more offspring. So it literally caused a further problem. So it's complicated. When you start playing around with animals, hormones and the like, it gets complicated. So I'm just wondering, without knowing exactly what that product is, but I'm assuming it's one of the insect juvenile hormones, which are these insect hormones that have been looked at for quite some time, and they have been somewhat promising, but in other cases somewhat surprisingly disappointing in their efficacy.
Let's take another call. Tom in Ironwood, Michigan has something for us. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling from the south shore of Lake Superior near the border of Wisconsin and the UP. And I spoke to you, a year or so ago, and explained a situation. I'm throwing you a slight curveball from the subject. But typically around July 4th, when the weather is hot and the breeze is from the south, we get an inundation of what I believe are barn flies. They're biting flies that, you know, resemble house flies.
Mm-hmm.
But they swarm in, not by the hundreds, not by the thousands, and I'm not exaggerating, by the tens of thousands. Mm-hmm. So if you stand outside on these, oh gosh, typically maybe 10 days through the summer, on and off, when the breeze is from the south, high temperature, high humidity, it seems, you stand outside for, 30 seconds, you'll have, let's see, I'm trying not to exaggerate, probably 200 on your body trying to bite you. And
boy.
Yes. And if you talk to anybody in this area, you'll get the same story. I don't expect that there's anything you could do or recommend. I think it's way beyond that. But I wanted to extend an invitation. You're a bug guy. You want to see something pretty fascinating, I would extend an invitation for you to visit. Having said that, because I want you to see, I am not exaggerating.
Wow.
Having said that, is there anything we could do in our yard, a half-acre yard, anything? We have guests. We have to call them and send them, tell them not to come.
Sure.
It's unbearable. Yeah.
Okay. So this is definitely what we call a stable fly. And stable flies breed in fresh or green organic matter. And so they're a problem in livestock operations because of the rotting hay and the like. But it's also been argued that they can breed on rotting seaweed. And, you know, it's maybe not to the degree, but I have had complaints up and along the Superior lakeshore. And it has been documented that stable flies can travel 200-300 miles. You know, and they've done this by marking flies and releasing them and catching a whole distance away. And so what I'm at a loss to come up with is exactly where the devil they're coming from. Now, what I think probably happens is because of the temperature change and the like, when they go over the water, I think if they're getting blown up, and you had mentioned about the kind of a southerly airflow, and I think it's like running into a wall when they get the cooler conditions of the water, and that's why they're accumulating along the shore. You know, they live for a couple, 3 weeks, and so life can be quite miserable. But as I said, what would be really interesting to know is where the devil is. Is it a somewhat local source? I can't believe I can blame this on the people in Nebraska or whatnot. You know, where you've got big cattle operations, but that's typically where we go look for. And it's not dry hay, it's wet hay. It's that stuff that's right in the interface between the ground and the hay bale that are starting to rot and the like. That's where... They also could breed in grass clippings, you know, but it's, you know, not these gazillions like you've got. So they said, it's a very curious thing of where the devil, and I've never heard a good explanation. As I said, speculate, could it be seaweed? I don't think you've got that much seaweed sitting on the lakeshore up there.
There we go, Tom. It's still a bit of a mystery as to where they're coming from, but there's no doubt that they're there. I could tell you that. Thank you for calling. Carol, in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I'm wondering about the click beetle. Is it common or natural in Wisconsin?
Okay, I'm not familiar. The cliff, C-L-I-F-F?
No. Click.
C-L-I-F-F.
Oh, click. I'm sorry. Click. Okay. So
I ran into one. It fell from a tree onto the sidewalk, and it was on its back.
Sure.
And I was out with the dog, and I heard this clicking noise. And I turned around. And I tell you, it looked like something mechanical. And this is how dumb I am. For about a moment, I thought it was from outer space. It was that strange looking, and it looked like it was made out of metal.
It's technically a whole family of beetles, and we have a number of species. Some, you know, only about 1/4 inch long. They have a really neat one that's 2 inches long that has two big eyes on the front called an eyed click beetle, which is almost looks like it's tropical. Their grubs are technically called wireworms, and some wireworms are agricultural pests. And then you get these adults that have that interesting mechanism where they flip between their thorax and abdomen. It sounds like you're snapping your fingers, and they use this to do a somersault. One of my favorite stories about click beetles, when I was running the lab, I had a Native American gentleman come in and tell me that it was in a tradition that when they would find a click beetle, they would find an arrowhead on the ground, and his grandfather had taught him that. But he didn't know what a click beetle really was for sure. So we went up to the museum where we've got, you know, well over 1 million insects, and I was going through the drawers, but when I pulled out the click beetle drawer, He said, that's them. So I found that really very interesting, you know, so that they could even identify it. So they're quite common, kind of secretive. The adults are attracted to lights at night. So a lot of time when you find them around the house, that's what happened is the lights drew them in. And then when the sun comes, you find them. But typically, they're more down in dead wood, down in leaf litter, those kind of places. And so you have to kind of go searching for them if you really want to find them.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Looking at all those insects that may be trying to get into your house or on your plants, or maybe just you have an interesting question or a curious question about insects in your neck of the woods. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Also gotten several nice emails with photos of insects. And if you have one that you want to send in, email it to us at ideas@wpr.org along with your questions. John in Mineral Point emailed to say he read an article in the Washington Post about a virtual worldwide decline in insect populations across all ecosystems, wondering what the average landowner can do to kind of help stem this loss and, you know, each of us in our own individual way.
Yeah, you know, this is a real perplexing problem that's kind of slapped us all. And I even go back to questions we had years past on the show of people saying, you know, I don't kill as many bugs on the highway as I did. And, you know, we were speculating about car designs. But now the evidence is coming out. Some of this started in Germany and in areas where they've been looking for decades. And there is a 60 to 70% decline right across the board. And what's disturbing is these are relatively stable environments. So it's not like you can blame it all on changes in land use and the like. And so, you know, you would say keep things as diverse as possible. You know, be very selective if you have to use any kind of chemicals that might alter the environment. But I'm fearful that this is a larger scale question and until we really get our handle on it. But to see those kind of staggering number losses worldwide in both cultivated areas and non-cultivated areas, you know, it's a real red flag. And as I said, we're really kind of pondering what could have that kind of impact because it is so widespread.
Sue in Brookfield, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Sue. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have, from some delayed gardening, I had put some soil on the patio and didn't get it taken care of before the end of the day. So the next morning when I was looking out the patio door, there were birds taking dust baths. And I'm wondering if they're getting rid of the mites from their feathers, do you have to change the soil in the dust bath if I keep putting new soil out there?
The mites on the birds shouldn't leave the body, and if they do, they got big problems. And so I'm not really worried about that, whether you want to use the soil in the house or, you know, mixing it outside. That shouldn't be a problem. You know, bird mites, when we get problems in people's homes, it's usually because the birds are nesting in the attic or, you know, right up against a window. And then when the baby birds leave, they've got no birds to pick on. And so the mites come in and they will bite people. It's a little bit mysterious. The bites kind of present, you know, kind of like an infected mosquito bite. I mean, they're very defined welts. What people have to be careful of is when you start doing research, the first mite site that comes up is called birdmites.com, and it is, the information there is not even close to being true. People talk about once you get bird mites, they never go away and they'll bother you for the rest of your life and all these other things, and they live in your body, and this is not true. So as I said, I really don't get cautious, and when people are concerned about bird mites and what might be going on, usually what we do is just remove the nest. And then maybe vacuum her a little bit and you're done with it, because they will not live off the host. And the same thing here is the dust does help the birds control the mite populations on their own feathers, but I'm not worried about the dirt becoming contaminated, if you think of it that way.
There you go, Sue. Thank you for calling. Randy in Springstead, it's your turn. Hi, Randy.
How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yes. I'm calling in. I've actually heard the last about 2 minutes of this, and talking about the decrease in insects worldwide. I'm a beekeeper. We run about 2,000 hives of bees, and we run them in Wisconsin in the summer, and we run them down to Florida in the winter. But we lose between 35% and 40% of our beehives every year that we end up replacing, replenishing, or splitting down in Florida to make back our numbers back up again. But that is really fairly well system-wide as far as beekeepers going, losing up to that many bees.
Yeah, but, you know, there I think the issues are so complicated because you've got varroa mites and you've got a number of diseases and the like that just kind of build up. And, you know, it's interesting. Back when I first started here, we used to have a USDA bee lab in Madison on campus. And even back then, because of the winters, that there especially was supposed to be trying to figure out how to get bees to overwinter successfully in northern climates. And they had a lot of problems. You know, so at least with honeybees, you can point to some things that are definitely not helping you. But when you look at literally tens of thousands of hundred thousands of species of insects, as I said, that seems much more systemic, much more, you know, I don't know, even climate change doesn't seem to fit well with me because, you know, we're talking about so many different environments. So as I said, it's really troubling. The bees thing on itself is troubling because of the losses and the importance of pollinators. But when you start looking at this widespread thing, I think it kind of all caught us all by surprise to see this much decline across the board.
And an author on the show, the title of his book is Buzz, and it's about bees in general, and honeybees certainly get talked about. There are some viruses. One of the other things they're looking at is viruses coming in from European bees that have been brought over, and that there's probably a whole combination of things that are working, at least in his mind, but the viruses have, you know, they can get a virus just like we can, apparently.
Oh, yeah. No, and you know, that's where the varroa mite seems to be one of the ways of these viruses getting introduced. So it's not just the mite pressure itself, but much like ticks spread us disease, varroa mites are capable of introducing. And, you know, and bees react differently. If they're well cared for, sometimes they can kind of limp along, and then they get stressed, then the viruses overtake them, much like a human body when we have disease issues.
Yeah, really interesting. Randy, thanks very much for calling. Keep up with the beekeeping and your bee work. Mike emailed this photo for an ID, and it looks like a segmented, well, maybe you can describe it.
Yeah, so it's the larval stage of a beetle. In particular, I'm a little suspicious it's a firefly larvae.
Ah!
Just from the looks of it. Now, I'd have to look a little bit more carefully because there are three or four other beetle families it could be. So there's no question it's an immature beetle, and it's probably a predator. This group generally, like, you know, fireflies, some of them feed on millipedes, some of them feed on slugs as their primary host. But and again, something you normally wouldn't see unless you're kind of turning over rocks or getting down litter, because these things are mostly active at night.
Little prehistoric looking.
Oh,
almost.
Yeah, neat critters. And, you know, some of them even have great, this one you can peek a little bit of pink and whatnot. I mean, they're really quite ornate if you look at them close enough.
Dave in La Crosse, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Just wondered if there's any specific treatment for apple maggots that won't hurt the bees and butterflies and good bugs.
You know, if you're looking for something organic, there is a product called spinosad, which is used. And spinosad generally is not harmful to bees in the level. And it will stop apple maggot if you're spraying it on the apples when the flies are coming in to lay their eggs in July and the like. The problem is you have to reapply it for at least a couple, three times, because the egg-laying period is such a long period of time. But you can kind of figure if it's going to kill apple maggots, there are other things. It kills caterpillars. Now, some of those are pests of apples. Some of them are kind of neutral in the like. And so it's very difficult to come up with something that is species-specific that causes mortality. So they said it's not it's considered a relatively reasonable product around bees, but I can definitely say that there will be non-target effects using that product if you select it. It is more selective, though, in what it kills than some of the broader spectrum pesticides that are used.
There you go, Dave. Thank you so much for calling. You know, we had a lot of calls this year, Phil, about Japanese beetles in some parts of the state. What's your view on the populations? Are they growing?
You know, to me, Japanese beetle is about a 15-year experience if you watch the way it normally moves in communities. And one of the problems we have, it's still getting introduced into new areas. So the first thing, and I will give you what we saw in Madison, is it started in 2000. It went crazy. Within 5 years, it was like a science fiction movie. And then 10 years later, now the population's 10% of what it used to be. Now, the other things that will factor that a little bit is mild winters, bigger populations, very lush late summers, bigger populations. But overall, to me, it's more a case of moving into new areas is more of an effect than anything else.
Yeah, I was thinking about our grape plants outside. Now, this last year, I don't remember seeing any damage from Japanese beetles on our grapevines.
Yeah, in versus 10 years ago, you probably didn't have any grapevines.
Yeah, they were really everywhere at that point. So not much you can really do to...
Well, as we talk so much on the show, because they're migrating in from a half mile down the road, you know, there's very little that you're going to do in your property. If you treat your lawn to kill grubs and whatnot, that's not going to affect what happens to your raspberries next summer, unfortunately.
Yeah. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, and we have some open lines for you. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us your questions or comments at ideas@wpr.org. You know, we had Susan email a picture of a cute little gray thing by. Any idea what that is? She wonders what it is. It's like a gray splotch. You're going to have to ponder that?
I would like to dissect it open. My first guess, it is a spider web mass. You know, they make an egg mass.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if it was a wasp structure or whatnot, it would take too long to get there. So
there we go. Well, Phil's going to be with us right up until 12:30, so call in 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Back with Phil right after this look at the news. Taking a look at all kinds of insects on the program today, I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, used to head the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab and retired in, already 2014. But he still comes by every few months to talk with us. This is great. Always nice to see Phil. And certainly he's here to answer your questions. The number is 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones. Bob and Ryo, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been using a product, and I won't name it, but it's 99.2% pure garlic juice. And I mix it with water and use it as an area spray. And I used to have a problem with stable flies and mosquitoes and ticks and jiggers, and it says it kills all of them, and based on my experience, it seems to be doing it without hurting the bees and the caterpillars and such. I was just wondering if Phil had any opinion on this.
Well, you know, a lot of work has went in the last 10, 15 years of looking at natural products as insecticides. In many of these products in nature, that's why the plants make them, is to keep the insects away from them. And so what you find is when you get down to the nitty-gritty, many of these are oil-based products. If you spray them directly on most critters, you will kill them. But where they seem to fall off to me is that they degrade so quickly. It's not like... You know, the difference between some of the synthetic chemicals that we've been using, that when you spray on a wall, anything that walks on that wall for the next month is dead type of thing, versus with many of these natural products, if you spray the critter in the laboratory setting, it dies. But if I spray it, let it dry, and the ant walks across it, it's not affected. So as I said, I don't doubt that this stuff works. The question is how long and under what circumstances. And you know, and the other thing that makes it difficult is with, you know, 25,000 different species of insects, you can get 25,000 different reactions. But in general, the natural products that are oil-based products do have a contact kill built into them in many cases. But what they fail to have is a residual kill down the road.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate the call. John in Brookfield, thank you for calling. John, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Yeah. What's on your mind?
Grubs in the lawn. Wondering what the best product and the best time to control those. This fall, actually about 2 weeks ago, I noticed quite a few grubs when I pulled back the sod. I tried treating them with one chemical by Bayer, and a week later they were still there. It didn't do anything. So I'm just wondering, when's the best time to control those things?
What complicates it is there's potentially two different kinds of grubs you've got. What I'm thinking you probably have is Japanese beetle grubs. They give a one-year life cycle. You would expect to find them in the highest numbers in late summer, fall, and then into early spring before they finally transform to the adults. The other grub that looks almost identical but will probably be a couple sizes bigger are white grubs, which is a 2 to 3 year life cycle, a related beetle but a different one. Typically, white grubs, because of that longer life cycle, they are not as common a lawn pest as Japanese beetles would be. Why it's important to tell the difference, though, is the timing to some degree. White grubs, for most people, if we got this late in the year, I'd say just let it go. There's not much you can do. Japanese beetles, if you were to talk the proper time to get the biggest impact, honestly, it's more in July and in early August when the grubs are very small.
Yeah.
In fact, there's some products even you can put on a little bit earlier and get it. But the results that you got putting it on this late is kind of what you expect. You don't get good efficacy out of the chemical. I've seen cases where lawns look tremendously poor in the fall and then come around again in the spring. The bigger problem we have with a lot of these grubs sometimes is things like skunks and raccoons tearing the sod apart to get at the grubs, and that causes more damage than the darn grubs can. But I said this late in the year, I really don't think it's anything that's going to be worth trying to treat. The product you've got down now will help to some degree, but I'm hoping that it lessens. And, you know, if you're talking Japanese beetle grubs, you need densities of about 10 or more per square foot minimum before you start getting turf damage. Anything less than that, the lawns will probably take. And what gets deceptive when you work with lawns is anything that causes brown patches. If you disturb them and find grubs, you might assume that it's always grub related. It may not be. It might be diseases or other things. But what's typical when grubs get bad is you can roll the grass back almost like it's carpet. You know, there's so little root structure because they've eaten all the roots away.
Yeah.
But this late in the year, what also complicates it is the grubs are moving down in the soil profile to get through the winter.
Oh, so
and then they come
deeper
up again in the spring.
Yeah.
So then again, it goes back wide in the middle of the year. And also, depending on the products, sometimes you need to water these products in to soak them down where they're effective. So it gets kind of complicated, unfortunately.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it. Kelly in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to go back to the conversation a little bit about bees and their immune response, that when they're stressed, there's, you know, numerous things that can impact the colonies. And I'm just wondering if Phil has anything to say. There was a recent study that I read about the effects of glyphosate, Roundup basically, on the microbiome of the bee's gut. And when I think about, you know, all the conversation around human microbiomes and keeping healthy gut bacteria in our bodies, you know, what this just seems really distressing and depressing, because if we're wrecking them from the inside out, I mean, there's no amount of sugar water you can give them in the winter, I think, that's going to help them thrive. So I'm just wondering what he's got to say about this new research coming out in the
agricultural. Thanks, Kelly.
On a slightly wider scale, I think what has been disturbing is we've tried to get a handle on the colony collapse disorder and all the other problems going on with bees, is that when you do an analysis of the pollen that is in the colonies brought in and whatnot, there is just an organic soup is the best way. There's fungicides, there's insecticides. This happens to be an herbicide. And so then the question is trying to tease out the various factors. In any case, if you're changing what's going on internally, that raises, you know, real questions. And so I think it has an impact. But as I said, my concern has been more just in general, that there's a whole bunch of strange chemicals that are there. And a lot of these things, the insecticides are straightforward because they're supposed to have a biological effect, but people were overlooking the herbicides and the fungicides. Because typically, if you spray it on the bee, you know, the bee isn't dead, so okay, it's non-toxic to bees. But that's only on the surface when you start looking at these other changes. So, yes, I think there's a lot going on there, and it all interplays. And that's why this collapse disorder is a very complicated subject when you get into all the little nuances and whatnot that might be affecting the balance.
Yeah, good points. Kelly, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Dee in Eland, it's your turn. Hi, Dee.
Hi there. I'm just wondering what you could tell me about carpenter ants and why they come into a place. We did some remodeling. We found some. We treated that area, but now I'm thinking about, you're talking about bugs coming in. Do I need to, can I spray around the house? Is there a way to prevent carpenter ants?
Sure. So there's two things to sort through with carpenter ants. If you see a couple ants in the kitchen in July, what usually is going on is these are workers that are coming from nests outside. Nothing to worry about. It's a nuisance, but, you know, it's not like they're going to set up housekeeping. When carpenter ants nest in a structure, typically they are looking for a softened, you know, kind of rotted wood or sometimes styrofoam and the like. And they are capable of nesting. And so the first question when somebody says, I got black ants running around, what I'm trying to sort through for them is, are these just coming in from outside or are they nesting inside? And some of it is, if you find an ant in January, there's no question they got to be nesting inside. If you're finding a bunch of ants in the bathroom, there's no food there, so why would ants come in from outside? So that would argue that they're nesting in the structure somewhere. But you got to keep in mind that the little black ants that you see are crawling around the house are sterile females, so they can't start a nest even if they wanted to. And so, as I said, watch the pattern. Kind of a general rule of thumb, any place other than the kitchen, if you consistently see 3-4 ants a day, In the warm period of the year, they're probably nesting, or you see any ants from about the 1st of November till at least maybe almost the 1st of May, they're nesting indoors. And then the question is, the best way to take care of them is to try to hunt the nest down and treat it directly. It doesn't take much, but that sometimes takes some detective work. There's other sprays. I mean, you can get commercial people have got certain sprays they can put on the outside that will take care of them. But don't overreact, I guess, is what it is. Is if you're just seeing a couple ants, they should stop by now. If they're still persisting, it could be they're nesting indoors. Or the other thing I will bring up at this time of the year is you do find carpenter ant colonies in firewood. And so sometimes when people store firewood indoors, that's how they bring the ants in. And it's a nuisance problem, nothing worse than that. But that could sometimes explain why the ants are crawling around at this time of the year.
Thank you, Dee. Appreciate it. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Quick question. I was recently taking pictures of a bunch of bees on my wildflowers in the yard, and had some awesome pictures of some cicada killers as well. But there was a weird one that was a little beetle, about 3/4 of an inch long, large bee size. It was a beetle, had really long antenna and no wings, and I'm assuming it's a beetle, but it looked exactly like a standard bee with stripes, black and yellow stripes all over it. Tried to look it up, but I couldn't find anything on it. I was wondering if you could tell me what that was. And also another thing, what's up with the takeover by stink bugs in the Madison area?
Yeah, well, the stink bug thing is easy. This is the invasion of the Marmorata stink bug, which has only been in the United States for about 15 years, not even that long, about 10 years. And they're just arriving here in numbers. And they're overwintering in the house. That's their game is to try to squeeze into things and then create a nuisance in particular. Now, the critter, I'm a little perplexed. I was thinking that it could be a meloid beetle, a soft-winged beetle, but they usually don't have that drastic color pattern. The long antennae, boy, I was thinking it could be a type of cerambycid beetle. You'd often see them working on pollen of plants. So that could be too, and there are some that are bee mimics. You've got the markings. In fact, the more I think of it, that's where I would look. Now, the problem is with the longhorn wood borers, the cerambycids, there are probably about 120 species at least that you could run into, and some look more like bees than not. Where I would suggest to go, there's a site, when I'm looking for critters, there's a site called Bug Guide. And what people do is they submit pictures, and then people identify them, experts identify them, and then they put it in a database. Now, the problem is if you got a little black bug and you're trying to identify it, there's tens of thousands of pictures. So, you know, it would take so long. But in this case, as I said, if you look under longhorned wood borer and just go through their images, I think you'll start to see some things that may look like bee mimics with a long antenna, and then you can kind of go deeper into it to help you identify it. So if you kind of know what you got, it's a very useful site. If you've got no idea, I think you'll probably be, as I said, disappointed, or maybe you'll be in awe just about all the neat critters that they got pictured there. So,
and Bug Guide, is it with two G's or one? Is it BUGGUIDE?
Right.
So two G's.
It's separate, Bug Guide.
Oh,
just do
okay.
That search and it will pop up. And as I said, all kinds of useful information, just an unbelievable collection of images.
And just to go along with that, Kenneth wondered if there are any natural predators for stink bugs.
There are, but until they get established, you know, that's typically what happens with invasives, is the reason that they get out of whack is the things that naturally control them aren't here. Now, what will happen with stink bugs is some of our native predators and parasites will probably cross over. But if they continue to be out of whack, what USDA will probably be doing, and I'm sure they've been doing it already, is go back to the country of origin, try to understand what affects their population there. But if you do find something, in trying to get it introduced in the United States is a 10 to 15 year process, because you've got to do all the research to make sure they don't have negative impacts. In some of our original problems from 50, 60 years ago, when we didn't quite do as diligent of a screening, turns out that we created problems with things we brought in here. And so now that's why the screening takes so long, is you have to find something that's very specific that will affect stink bugs without affecting other things. And so, as I said, I'm not aware of any research. There might be some of that going on, but even if it is, it's not going to be a quick fix.
We had, by the way, you can join in, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly on open lines. Mark emailed in a photo to say he found this caterpillar, pretty one, in the Cattle Moraine area. It looks kind of like a woolly bear caterpillar, but is more than twice the size. It's kind of almost a light cream color with a big black fuzzy...
Yeah, and in fact, I think in between the segments, it almost is a pinkish to red.
Yeah.
I think this is the caterpillar of something called a leopard moth, and a neat critter even in the adult stage. It's in that same family. There's a number of fuzzy larvae that you will find. But as I said, this one, because I have seen it before, is, I think, the larval stage of a leopard moth.
It's really, really... kind of pretty, actually.
Yeah, I neat critters, and as I said, in this case, you know, so many moths grow up to be kind of boring brown gray things. Leopard moths, it's worth taking a look at a picture, because they are pretty impressive critters.
Well, we have some more callers online. We can take your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us again at ideas@wpr.org. Always love to hear from you. Linda saw this on her car, a photo of a green...
A praying mantid. Which are not native to Wisconsin. In fact, there's both an Asian species and a European species in the U.S. There are some native mantids in both the Southeast and Southwest. But this is one of, you know, my favorite line on this show has always been, the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us.
Yeah.
Well, mantids could never survive the winter here. Their egg cases would freeze out. But now we have breeding populations in the southern third of the state and up in Door County also. And this is all because of the lack of cold weather in the winter. And so things have changed. So mantids can be found here naturally. If we ever had a incredibly severe winter with 35 below statewide for a period of time, it probably would knock them down. But we have not seen that. And so, as I said, it's a pleasant new introduction. Some introductions not so pleasant. Mantids are nice.
Anne in northern Wisconsin has a question. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I discovered we have bed bugs, and I just would like to know, what is the life cycle of them? And we are cleaning and treating, and we did have a pest control person come, and he said he felt like what we were doing was doing a good job, but how long is it going to take us to treat these?
So, you know, although human bedbug has become a major issue in the last 10 years throughout the world, but especially for us here, the other thing that I always do when people say they have bedbugs, there's a species associated with bats, there's a species associated with barn swallows, and honestly, they tend to be far less problematic and much easier to control. The major reason why we've had such a problem with human bedbugs is they're resistant to so many of the treatments that we have. And so I'm fearful that you cannot clean your way out of this because they are so insidious. Their populations can double and triple in 3 months' time. And you know, because they're basically laying a number of eggs, and as I said, it's about a 3 month life cycle normally, but the female will lay a clutch of eggs every day, and so they can, like any insect, explode geometrically. What did the pest control service do? Did they spray, or did they do a heat treatment? Or
no, he actually just examined the rooms where we had found them. And so it was in like two bedrooms, and basically it started in the living room.
Okay. Do you have anybody in the household that has quite a bit of travel history? Have you brought any used furniture in the house in the last 6 months?
No, none of that. We did not travel ourselves any place.
Okay. Well, then again, I honestly think it would be worth the effort of catching a couple and sending it down to PJ Leash, who is the person that took over the diagnostic lab when I retired, for proper identification. Because, as I said, I'm nervous. If it's a bat bug, the problem's coming out of the attic, they're migrating in, and you should be able to solve that problem yourself. If it's human bed bug, they are just so aggressive and so hard to kill that, as I said, I think there's nothing I can send you to the store to get that's going to solve the problem for you. And so I want to make sure that you got this properly identified so your strategy will give you some chance for success. Because, said, I mean, I can kill bed bugs out in front of me quite easily with a whole bunch of products. But the problem is they get in the seams and hide away in places you can't get to. And that's where you've got to be more aggressive. And as I said, why cleaning by itself won't stop them.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Dennis in Oshkosh, you have a question for us.
Yes. Hi, gentlemen. Yes, I do. And I think proposing an impossible task, but we hear a cricket at night, we think it's in the tree, and the best description I can give the sound is, I don't know if you guys are old enough, is a pogo stick, the springing of a pogo stick.
Oh, all right.
And
okay, so if it's
in the it's during like when the sun is setting. Any guesses? I found a ground striped cricket, which is kind of sound like it, but my friend says it's not.
Yeah. Honestly, when I get calls of things singing in trees, I'm usually more suspicious it might be a longhorn grasshopper, katydids, and some of their relatives, where the males are very territorial and very noisy in the late summer. Although I would think things slowed down now with the cooler temperatures, or is it still making noise?
No, not anymore.
Okay, yeah. Go to the University of Michigan. You know, if I remember right, they have a site. I know they've got one on cicadas, but I think they've got one on katydids. Or just do a search on katydid calls and then go through it. I think you'll find one, because you honestly can identify the species by the pattern of the chirping or rattling that they do.
There you go, Dennis. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Phil, thank you so much. Well, you'll be back with us.
Probably December. Every couple months, you're going to have to put up with me. So
December 19th. Are you making any progress on your book?
No snow on the ground. So I will again. Honestly, it's getting close. Now is the hunting season. So unfortunately, now is not a good time to write.
Okay. Phil Pelletieri will be back on December 19th, and we'll do it all over again with him. It's always fun to have him along. And you know what? Tomorrow, we're going to take a look at your tires. Are they ready for winter driving? Vehicle maintenance specialist Jim Ward is back tomorrow to talk about what you need to know to make sure your car is safe for nasty weather conditions. That's at 11 o'clock tomorrow. In the meantime, hey, stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.